This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is Monday, July 24th, 2006. It's approximately 8 a.m. We're at the UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. My name is Cheryl McQuaid, also present.
Jerry Smith.
And today we're interviewing Mark Van Epps. Mark, would you state your name and spell it for us?
Yep, my name is Mark Van Epps. It's Mark, M-A-R-K. Van Epps is V-A-N, capital E-P-P-S.
And what is your address?
9988 West Clark Road, Grand Ledge, Michigan, 48837.
Are you married? Do you have children?
Yes, I am married, and I have three daughters.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Lakewood, California. My dad was in the Navy at the time, and I was raised in Grand Ledge, Michigan.
And what is your educational level?
Graduated high school, and I've taken several college courses, but I do not have any college degrees.
What did your parents do in Grand Ledge?
My mother stayed home primarily and then worked at the public library, and my dad was a powertrain engineer here for Oldsmobile in Lansing.
Were you ever in the military?
No.
And what did you do before you hired into Fisher Body?
I worked at Lindell Drop Forge. I worked as a die sinker.
When did you hire in?
1984, August of 1984.
And why?
The Lindell Drop Forge was a fabulous place to work, and it's where I learned my trade, but they were very clearly going out of business. And I hired into Fisher Body because they were hiring, and I knew I had to make a move. So,
how did you find out they were hiring?
Word of mouth from some other people that I worked with at the Drop Forge.
Was the hiring process lengthy, or?
It was very brief. I submitted an application, got a call back right away, and came in for an interview and was told to report for a physical the next day.
So no long lines?
Nope. It was real easy.
What was your first day like walking into the plant?
My first day, I wasn't even really sure what my job was going to be. I knew that I was being hired as a tool maker to maintain the tools and equipment on the production line, but I'd never been in that type of a manufacturing environment. The Lindell Drop Forge, we made single parts, and of course, Fisher Body was a huge assembly plant, so I didn't really even know what my job was going to be, but I reported at the Verlinden Gate, and I was met there by my first supervisor, who was Pat Finch. And Pat's nickname was Scooter, and Pat put me on the back of his scooter and drove me to about the middle of the body shop to what was known as the B car track. And he dropped me off and pointed on the other side of the line to a work area where there was three other guys sitting and sent me over there. And I didn't even know what my job was. If it hadn't been for the other guys, I wouldn't have found out what I was supposed to be doing, but.
Can you tell us what your thoughts were as Pat was driving you down to that body shop and seeing that environment?
I was real happy to be there. I was really happy to get that job. It's something I had really wanted. But I was pretty intimidated because, like I said, I had no idea what was expected of me. And I thought he was dropping me off to start working on something, and I wasn't sure what that was. But he sent me over to the other three guys that I mentioned, and it was my first partners. It was Marv Bruner, Dick Reynolds, and Paul Bennett, who also were toolmakers, and he sent me to that area, and those guys showed me around, showed me what my job was. So they made me real comfortable and invited me right in, but it was pretty intimidating.
What shift were you hired in on?
I hired in on the second shift.
And how old were you when you hired into the plant?
I was 24. I hired in August, and my birthday was in September, so I was almost 25 years old.
Did you have any interaction with the people on the line?
Yep, I had lots. That turned out to be really what my job was to support those people. And so I had a lot of interaction with them.
What was your feeling about the line workers?
They were obviously a hardworking, good bunch of people. I had a lot of fun with them, and they were a really good group, so.
And how long did you do that job?
I did that job, I'd have to guess a little bit here, but on and off, I've done that job my whole career in various parts of the body shop.
So most of your time or all of it was spent in the body shop?
Yeah, that's right. A little bit of time in trim, but almost all of it was in the body shop.
Were there any new hire initiations or pranks pulled on you?
No, not really. It was a pretty friendly group that I settled in with, so there weren't really any pranks. It was a big changeover time. There was an A line and a B line, and the B line was the first to start up. The A line wasn't even running yet. So when you weren't working on the line you were assigned to, you were usually off working on a job somewhere else. So there wasn't any free time, really.
What did you do? Can you tell me what a typical day was like?
Yeah, I guess so. A typical day was, I think the shift, if I remember right, back then started at 4:48. And so you'd come in, interact with the previous shift, you know, find out where the breakdowns were, where the problems were, kind of circulate through the area and look things over, talk to people. Have a cup of coffee, and then it was mostly monitoring the production line, waiting for something to fall off, and which is something always did break, and then you'd set about repairing it. So that was a typical day. Every day was something different, and it stayed pretty interesting for the first couple of years.
What did you do for your lunches, your breaks?
Usually just stayed right there in the area.
Brought in a lunch?
Yeah, brought in a lunch. I couldn't find my way. Early on, the drop forge was, you know, covered maybe 5 acres. And, of course, the Fisher Body plant was you know, a couple hundred acres, probably at least. And to even go to the bathroom and find my way back to the work area took me a couple of weeks of wandering around. So I usually kept my lunch pail within sight, so I knew I could find it.
What did you think when you finally did venture out into, did you ever go to the paint department, Jim?
Yeah, I walked around and got a chance to sightsee a little bit. So the place was fascinating to me. I mean, I came from a lot smaller environment, and it was really interesting to see all the technology, even at that time, of what it took to assemble a car.
Did you develop any friendships that extended outside of the plant?
Yep, I already had a group of gentlemen that came to Fisher Body with me from Lindell Drop Forge, so I knew that group. And then the other tradespeople that I worked with every day, you know, there were electricians and pipe fitters and millwrights and other trades, and we ended up, you know, you'd bowl in a bowling league or play golf, you know, get out of work and go play golf in the morning or things like that. And I made a lot of friends in there. So
during your working hours, if the line was running smooth and there was nothing to fix, what did you do?
Usually could clean up your area, you know, redo your parts drawers, make sure you had all the spare parts you needed. A lot of times we'd make spare parts or stage a job for something, you know. But the way it was back then particularly is you knew you had a job waiting for you at the end of the shift. Something would break and you'd patch it up, and you'd have to be ready to fix it after the line went down. Everybody else would go home, and then the tradespeople would stay and do their repair job. Sometimes you'd stay till the day shift came back in. But you'd spend that time staging tools and staging parts quite often in order to be ready to start working once the production crews went home.
You mentioned that your father worked at Powertrain.
Yep.
Did you have any other family that worked?
I had my grandfather on my dad's side worked at Oldsmobile and was a local 652 member. My dad worked for Powertrain Engineering. My uncle Dwayne was a fixture repair supervisor, and he ended up, when he retired, he was a maintenance superintendent at Oldsmobile on the 652 side. I had my Uncle Bill also worked in engineering here in Lansing. My dad and Uncle Bill both worked in Building 66 in the Oldsmobile headquarters that are over on Elm in Townsend. I had an uncle on my mother's side that worked in Flint.
Um, Did you ever do any government projects for line workers or?
That was, yeah, nothing really big. Usually it was, helping them out with something. Maybe they brought a lawnmower blade in from home or a bad bearing or something, and they needed a little repair work done on it. And it was kind of one of those courtesy things that you had with the other trades and with production people where, they're tied to the line and working every single minute. And especially back in the early days, everybody's working 10 hours a day, and you're working Saturdays. A lot of times you're working Sundays. You're short of time. So they'd bring stuff in. If you had a few minutes, you'd help them out and fix something for them, for maybe a little project they had at home or something along those lines. So,
did you ever make any kind of tool that wasn't an everyday tool? It was something to assist them to help their job easier?
That was part of a toolmaker's job. And once again, especially in the early days, a lot of stuff was done with hand fixtures. And, everybody was always looking for a way to take some of that workload off of the person that had to use that fixture all day long. So I can't think of a specific example, but we were constantly modifying or adjusting things to make the jobs a little more user-friendly. So,
has a coworker impacted your family life at all?
I can't think of a specific example. I've got friends that I've made at work that have gotten to know my family and vice versa. But so I guess there's been an impact in that way. It's broadened our circle of friends a lot and had a lot of fun with the people that I work with. But other than that, not really.
Did you view your co-workers as brothers and sisters?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, especially in the plant and on the job. Team build is the big deal today, but it was always a team for most of us in some form or fashion.
I'd like to know a little bit about, once again, the area that you were in. Did you participate in departmental dinners, Christmas dinners? Was that something that the body shop would invite you into, a department dinner? Did skilled trades have their own dinners?
Yeah, there was a pretty broad spectrum of those types of things. I worked all over the body shop during my time on the plant floor, and probably the most interesting place would have been the door shuttle, which was kind of a new invention in the late 80s, early 90s. They designed and manufactured a tool that was just for putting the header on a door. And the header, of course, is the band that rolls around the top of the door that encloses the window. And it seems like a really simple process, but they built this enormous, really complex machine. And everybody that worked on the door shuttle was working 10 or 12 hours a day. It broke constantly. And for whether you were a production or a salaried person or a maintenance person, everybody on the door shuttle got to be really close friends. And to the point of where the skilled trades guys were running relief for the production people because they were working so much. So we all took turns doing each other's jobs. But that in that environment, we had dinners all the time over there. Every time, at least once a week, somebody'd bring in fish they caught or a deer they shot, or there was always something that people were bringing in, to share with their coworkers. Kind of on a broader scale, as I moved around the body shop, there was always an area dinner, whether it was a holiday, before Thanksgiving, before Christmas, or Labor Day, Easter, all those things. There'd be a dinner, in the area, and then quite often the maintenance department would have some kind of a big dinner also. So, and, of course, retirements. Always had a big party for retirements.
How did you find the area, the space, to have these dinners? I mean, how did you keep things hot? How did you keep them cold?
Crock pot. Or back then, we used to have, we had made taken an old toolbox and we made an oven out of it, a warmer. I don't remember what, I think we used a big light spotlight for a heating element, but we could, a lot of times for a really big dinner, we'd go like almost have it catered, get chicken or something, a whole bunch of chicken from a caterer, and then bring it in, keep it in the warmer, and everybody would bring a dish to pass. So, of cooler full of pop and then a dish to pass. So it was pretty simple, just like any picnic or potluck might be.
So it was the management didn't have a problem with this?
But most of the areas I was in, management participated.
Okay. What about plant vending, people that sold food items?
Yeah. There was a lot. There was quite a bit of that. You know, a lot of pop salesmen. The third shift, when I was on midnights, there was a millwright that had a store back in one of the cribs. And it was not a for-profit store. He sold pop and candy and gum and all kinds of stuff. But every Friday a month, he had made enough money, he bought a popcorn machine. And one Friday a month, he would make popcorn and give it away to anybody that wanted it. So everybody from all over the body shop could smell that popcorn and they'd come and get it. And then he would have pizza parties or, you know, something along those lines. And then whatever money was left after that, he would always donate to a charity of some sort. So it was fun for the employees to be able to have an alternative to kind of a crummy vending machine.
You mentioned Pat Finch was your first supervisor.
Yep.
And I never worked for Pat Finch. However, I did know him and liked him. He was a very nice man.
Yep.
What made a good or a bad supervisor, in your opinion?
In my opinion, the good supervisor was a supervisor that trusted you to do your job and didn't worry about what you were doing every second. The bad supervisor was the one that took your chair away because it sent the wrong message, or didn't support you with the right tools to do your job, or was constantly questioning your ability to do your job, but your work ethic. You know, the person that would come around, why are you doing that? What are you doing? How come you're not over there? I tell you what, the best supervisor I think I ever had was a guy named Don Davis. And Don you never had to worry about whether Don was going to follow you around on the job. And I tell you, people would go out of their way to do a good job for Don because they liked him so much. And they knew that they didn't have to worry about whether or not Don was, you know, was protecting them or had their back, as you might say. So that was the difference to me.
Could you tell us about your worst supervisor?
I don't want to mention his name, but yeah, I had a really bad supervisor, and I already kind of described him. He would be at your work area about 1 minute after starting time, you know, with a threat and a promise, and you know, he just was his expectations of his people were very unrealistic. You know, it was more important for him that you look busy than you actually be busy. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew that if something went wrong, he would blame you and would never take any responsibility for it himself. He would write people up just because he didn't like them. And he frankly had no credibility either with his hourly people, and he didn't have any credibility with the other management people either. So
did you go out of your way to do a good job for him?
I went out of my way to avoid him. So, you know, and I always figured I had a job to do no matter who I was working for. So I came to work the same day, and I did my job the same way no matter who I was working for, because I was working for the people who had to use the tools in the area I supported. I wasn't going to make them pay because the guy I was working for wasn't a good supervisor. So I came to work the same way every day. But I would avoid a person like that, and I wouldn't do anything to help them and help, you know, anything out of the ordinary, but I wouldn't make someone else suffer because my relationship with him was bad.
Could you share with us one of your best memories of Fish About It?
Let me see. I think some of my best memories, let's see. I really liked my job, and I really liked, for the most part, the people that I was working with. Probably my best memories would have been maybe when in the mid to late 90s, I was on a bowling league with a couple of guys that had retired. It was Jerry Post, who was a retired electrician, Willie Campbell, who was a retired millwright, and then there was a guy named Keith Sheldon, whose nickname was Red Wing, and Red Wing was a material driver. And there was the four of us, and then every year we'd look for a fifth person. It was Scott Bates, who was a production employee, was on our bowling team on and off for a couple of years. But I used to bowl with those guys, and they were all good bowlers, and they were all nice guys, and I liked it because they were the kind of guys that you could go bowl, drink two or three beers, and then go home. They weren't stay at the bowling alley all night. They didn't get in any trouble, and they liked to win, but if they didn't, it wasn't a big deal to them. They were fun guys to work with, too, before they retired. And then we would go out of town and bowl in city tournaments, state tournaments, and we always bowled in the UAW tournaments and stuff. So I made the friends in the plant, but some of the memories, I guess, were from the activities outside of the plant. But.
Lansing has always been known as the capital of quality. Why do you think it's called that?
I think it's called that because it's legit. I think that Lansing has always built a quality product, and I've always thought that the hourly workforce has always done whatever they could or whatever they had to do to build a quality car. And I've always thought, it's not a contest, but when it comes to change, you have management needs to change, and the hourly people needs to change. And I always thought the hourly people were more willing and able to change and do the things that were needed to build a quality car than management was. And management was always ready at some levels, but they had a harder time adjusting to changes than the production people did or than the maintenance people did. And I think it's known as the capital of quality because of the extraordinary lengths that people would go to make sure that their jobs were done right.
Mark, could you tell us what your job title is now?
Currently, my job title is the Joint Training Representative.
And when did you take this position? Is this right after you left tooling?
Well, like I said, I hired in 1984, and I can't remember all of the dates without looking at my resume. But I worked there, I think it must have been in the late 80s, maybe 1990, somewhere in that range. They had posted a job for a suggestion analyst. And I was starting to get kind of bored, and looking for something different, or maybe a different perspective. And it was a temporary position. They went in two-year cycles. So I applied and got selected as a suggestions analyst, is what they called it. Did that for a couple of years and then went back to being a toolmaker. The next appointed job I took, they had a committee called a work practice committee that was set up to help tradespeople work on lines of demarcation issues. So I went on the work practice committee for a couple of years. From that, I went into the training activity. They eliminated the work practice committee through the local negotiations when we had a local agreement or local settlement. But they transitioned me into a needs analysis person for the training activity. So I did that for probably 4 or 5 years. Now, the joint training representative jobs really started about 2 years ago. And my predecessor was Kevin Goff. And Kevin retired just at the end of June. And they assigned me to work with Kevin during this launch for the Delta plant in order to learn the joint training representative job. So it's really, I've been doing it for like 2 years. But Kevin was still around as a mentor for me, so.
You mentioned lines of demarcation. What are lines of demarcation?
Lines of demarcation are the work rules that exist between skilled trades, management people, and production people that helps all parties understand what your job is and what your job isn't. And mostly they're designed around the safety of the employee. An electrician, for example, is trained to perform specific functions, and a lot of what they do is dangerous. Same thing with a millwright or a toolmaker or a pipe fitter. an electrician's job assignment is to do the things they're trained to do. And in most instances, no one else should be doing that work because it's just not safe for them to do it. Well, occasionally there's issues that come up and there's disagreement over who should do what work, or it's just not real clear. So the lines of demarcation or the work practices committee was employed to review the content of some of the work, mostly the skilled trades work, and help the shop committee make a decision on what would be the most appropriate trade to assign that work to.
And that was mostly skilled trades? And did that reach into the production area?
A little bit, but not very often.
And then you had mentioned needs analysis. Could you explain that job a little bit?
Needs analysis was a training function, and the gist of it would be, I guess one of the biggest jobs I did while I was on there was to write task and needs analysis documents for all the skilled trades people in the plant. I didn't do this by myself. I had some other people helping me, but the idea was to take, for example, a toolmaker's job and make a list of all the tools a toolmaker would need to use to do their job, all the skills that person would have to possess in order to be to perform at a high level, and all the knowledge that they would have to have in order to perform at a high level. So that's what a needs analysis would identify, all of those things. And then it would also, you would use that along with a skills assessment to help identify training needs for an individual. So
you mentioned safety. Did you ever see anybody, any coworkers, get hurt in the plant?
Yep. I'm trying to think. I've seen three or four things. I saw a guy in a man lift raising himself up. An electrician had his hand on the rail of the man lift and pinched his fingers between the rail on the hand lift and a beam in the ceiling. I saw a guy rigging a transformer with the forks on a fork truck, lifting a transformer, and he was using an I-beam, and the beam fell off the forks and hit him on the head, which didn't hurt him very bad, but you asked me, so I did see that. And then the worst one was an electrician that got caught in part of the mechanical devices of an underbody press, and I didn't see the accident, but he was in a place where no one could see him, and we heard him yelling, and went up and found him, and he was injured. He was hurt really bad.
Mike Quinteri.
Yeah, and he lived, very thankfully. He's a great guy, and but that was really sobering. That particular incident there was really scary.
And what do you think about the safety department in the plant? I've always heard that for every accident, there's a new safety rule. Is that how it works? Do you think these accidents?
I think that maybe might have been the truth at one time, but I don't think it is anymore. When I hired into Fisher Body in 1984, we had a better safety program at Lindell Drop Forge than we had at Fisher Body. You know, in the Drop Forge, you would go work on a press or you know, some similar tool, and there were very strict rules about lockout and about you know, isolating the mechanical, you know, movement, and if you didn't follow the rules, you got fired, and that was just it. And then when I got hired at Fisher Body, there wasn't even a place to put a lock. They didn't even have locks. You had all this, and I don't know how it ended up that way, but you had all this automated equipment, and you would go into a tool, and there wasn't even any place to put a lock. You had a red tag that you hung over the start button so that no one would push the start button while you were in there. Which happened to me.
That happened?
That's an interesting story there. Yeah. There was a tool called the milling drill, which the car would come in and it closed up. It was big gates that closed on both sides of the car. Clamped the car up, and then it would drill two holes and machined off a flat spot where they would mount the screws for the bottom of the front fender. Well, the drills always broke or got dull and you had to change them. So I had shut it off and I turned off the transfer that ran the car in there and I went in to change the drills. Well, while I was standing in there, and you had to stand in there and straddle, you were pretty much trapped in the tool. While I was in there changing the drills, I heard the transfer come on. And I looked up and there was a car coming down the line into the station that I was standing in. So I had to, just enough time to climb inside of the car while the tool did it, ran its process. And then I had to ride it through three more stations before I could get out on the platform where the production people worked. That was pretty.
Who turned it on?
A supervisor. A supervisor had walked over there and moved my tag and turned it on. And then left.
Thankfully you weren't hurt.
Yeah.
So when did you start seeing a change in the safety at Fisher Body?
I think it's mostly was an engineering issue. You know, 1984 was a huge changeover into lots of automated equipment. I think the next one was in 92 or 87 was 87 was every time they brought in more automation it got better. But they never could seem to quite get everything interlocked so that using lockout was practical. There was the Robigate system in the car track area where I first started working took like 26 locks to isolate it, which, you know, it's just not a practical way to work. But I think there was always a desire on management's part and on the Arrow people's part to be able to use lockout effectively, but they never could engineer it into the system well enough to really make it 100%. And I think we're probably there with this new Delta project.
I think we interviewed Steve that was with lockout, and he had said that there were, because there were
Steve
so
Pattinger.
Many... Yeah, there were so many locks, it was just too cumbersome to use.
See, right, at Fisher Body, we were always retrofitting a new tool into a site with a bunch of existing tools. And plus, I don't think the technology existed in the industry to really support it the way we would have liked to. You know, and a lot of the issues were you could shut off the power to the whole area, but we were going into an era where things were controlled by computers. And you know, this was early in that type of engineering, and you'd shut down the power on a robot, and the computer would lose its memory. So, you couldn't do it as a practical matter, even though from a safety standpoint it was the right thing to do. You couldn't reprogram every robot every time you had to go, you know, turn a screw, so.
Mark, I really want to thank you for spending this time with us this morning. Is there anything you'd like to share with us that we've not asked you?
Just the only thing is, when I got hired at Fisher Body, I was really proud of that, partly because I really wanted the job, and it was one of the first jobs I ever got where I didn't know somebody. You know, I didn't have a neighbor or a relative or somebody that got me in. I got in on my own merits and on my own credentials, and I was proud of that. And I knew that that it was really an opportunity to improve the standard of living for myself and for my family. It's not always fun, and I've had bad experiences at work like we all do, but for the most part, I really like working for this company, and I'm really proud of my union membership, and I'm really proud of our local and the people that work here. I think Lansing is successful because of those people, and I have absolutely no regrets whatsoever about choosing this as a career path, and I feel very fortunate to be here. Other than that, I don't have anything else I need to share. So,
well, thank you very much.
Yep, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I'm back, and I'm gonna tell you about how my job interview went. And I had submitted my application for employment, and I got a call to come in for a job interview. And the interview was to be conducted by Jerry Watrous, who was like a seventh-level supervisor in the layout department. and Larry Messias, who was an hourly supervisor for the tool makers. So I went and they took me to an office to do the interview. And I sat down with Jerry, and Jerry was waiting for Larry. Larry was late to the interview, which was typical Larry, as it turned out. So Jerry talked to me about his kids, and he talked to me about the war in Vietnam, which, of course, was long over. And he talked to me about a few other social issues. Never asked me anything about my work history or my background or my abilities. And finally it got to the point, and Larry never did show up, but it finally got to the point where I said, well, geez, Jerry, I'd really like to work here if you guys have a job for me. And he said, well, come on in for a physical tomorrow. And that was my entire job interview. I asked him what tools I should bring to work with me, and he said, well, a hammer and a chisel and maybe some Allen wrenches. And that was it. So when I did finally come to work, I was totally unprepared for anything. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but it was. I'm glad I came anyway.
Did you bring the hammer, the chisel, and the Allen wrenches?
Yeah, I brought a hammer, a chisel, some Allen wrenches, and I think I might have brought a crescent wrench. But I didn't. No one seemed to know what else I needed, so that was all I brought.
Well, thank you for that memory, Mark.
You're welcome.